Joan Rivers was more than a legendary comedian. She was an icon and a role model to millions, a fearless pioneer who left a legacy of expanded opportunity when she died in 2014. Her life was a dramatic roller coaster of triumphant highs and devastating lows. The suicide of her husband, her feud with Johnny Carson, her estrangement from her daughter, her many plastic surgeries, her ferocious ambition, and her massive insecurities. The Joan Rivers story is told in the new biography, Last Girl Before Freeway, the wife, loves, losses, and liberation of Joan Rivers. It is by Leslie Benitz. Benitz is a veteran journalist who was the first woman ever to cover a presidential campaign for the New York Times and was a contributing editor for Vanity Fair for nearly a quarter century. It is a great pleasure to welcome Leslie Benitz to the roundtable this morning. Leslie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you. What brought you to this project of wanting to tell the story of this incredible woman?
Well, she is an extraordinary figure. I've been writing about some of the most famous people on the planet for decades, but I don't think I've ever encountered a subject who was more complicated and paradoxical and fascinating and infuriating and inspiring as Joan Rivers. Her life story is really one for the record books because she was ruined in midlife and then at an age when most people just kind of, you know, quietly fade into oblivion, she made the comeback of all time and built a billion-dollar business in her 60s and 70s, and it's really an extraordinary story.
It certainly is an extraordinary story. Let us go to her initial success, which is also an extraordinary story, which you talk about in the book, which was basically is a young woman who likes to make people laugh.
Yes, and for her, it was a way of getting love. She grew up feeling as though she was not pretty, and people told her she wasn't talented and she wasn't funny, and she wanted to be an actress and nobody would cast her in any roles. But when she got up in front of an audience, if she was able to make people laugh, to her, that was the purest form of love you could experience in the world. And it affected her sort of, I mean, she was like a junkie. She was just addicted to that kind of adulation all of her life, and she chased it and she loved it more than anything. So for her, that was the big payoff.
When you look at those early days, I mean, not only was she defying odds personally, but also in the field of comedy, was really breaking a glass ceiling and coming into
a
field
total boys club
dominated by men. So how much of that, I mean, I remember talking to her about this and she sort of brushed it off and saying, you know what, I did it and I was good and that's why I survived. Did she understand exactly what she was doing at the time?
No, I don't think in any way. She didn't set out to change the world. She just had this fierce ambition and this incredible need to perform and to, you know, seek out opportunities to get up on stage, which was really, really difficult. The boys' club was very hostile. They didn't want girls breaking in. And there really weren't a lot of female comedians in those days. And when women did get on stage, they weren't supposed to, you know, talk about anything that would ruffle any feathers. So there were a lot of barriers for Joan, and she just wouldn't take no for an answer. Her lifelong motto was never give up, never quit. And she would write that never, never, never with about 18 exclamation points. So that was really what drove her, was this, you know, this incredible desire to become a star. And inadvertently, she ended up changing the world because she broke down all these barriers for women in comedy. All of the hottest names in comedy these days are women. But she also changed the content because back in the day, women, you know, when Joan was 8.5 months pregnant, she went on the Ed Sullivan Show, and he wouldn't even let her use the word pregnant, even though her pregnancy was extremely obvious. It was quite visible. But women weren't supposed to talk about anything having to do with bodily functions. And now, oh my God, you go to any comedy club and you listen to what the young women talk about, and it's enough to curl your hair, you know? And that was because Joan was fearless, and she just kept on mowing down all of these barriers and prohibitions for women until she kind of obliterated a lot of them and really freed everything up for the women who followed her.
One of the things that is fascinating about that, because even, and you talked about this at the beginning of our conversation about having her career wrecked and then coming back and in her 50s, but mm-hmm. the fact that she was where she was before that meltdown, a time where young comedians were coming, they were working the clubs of the 80s, but here she was as...
She was the queen of comedy. That's what People magazine called her in a cover story.
That's right.
She was at the top of the heap. And then everything, she just completely crashed and burned.
And so, a lot of this, of course, had to do with the fallout with Johnny Carson.
Yes, she was his permanent substitute guest host, and she was doing really well on The Tonight Show, which had made her into a star. And she was actually getting better ratings than Johnny was, let alone all of the other guys who sometimes substituted for him. But she became convinced that NBC was going to pass her over and choose a man to replace Johnny, because that's the inside information she had received. And she felt betrayed, so she turned around and betrayed Johnny and created her own late-night television talk show on Fox, which was a new network then. And Johnny felt totally betrayed by her and, you know, wouldn't ever take a phone call from her again, and there was this feud that lasted for decades. She didn't make it back onto NBC, onto The Tonight Show, until right before she died.
With Jimmy Fallon. What was
it? Jimmy Fallon, yeah.
What was it? How much of that decision and the machinations there were her, and how much were of her husband?
Yeah, that's a very complicated story. Her husband, Edgar, was her manager and a wannabe producer who was not able to really establish himself as a power in the entertainment industry in his own right. So he was kind of riding his wife's coattails, and the show on Fox offered him the opportunity to be a producer. So he was pushing her to leave Carson and do this because it would give him, Edgar, a real career. So I, in the book, go into, there's a sort of a mystery at the core of the Carson debacle, because in some ways it's a he said, she said thing where, you know, NBC denied that they were going to betray her. She felt that they were, and there's a secret memo that was leaked. It's a very complicated story. But basically, Edgar was a terrible producer, and Fox demanded that Joan fire him, and she refused. She chose her husband over her job, not realizing that Fox would go ahead and fire her and bounce her from the job. So it kind of brought her husband kind of brought them both down, and then he was not able to live with the shame of what had happened, so he committed suicide. So it was like a full-blown catastrophe. Just everything in Joan's life was ruined all at once, her professional life, her personal life, her family life. And then she found out that Edgar had, who was her business manager, had squandered all of her money on bad investments. She'd lost her whole fortune, and she was $37 million in debt, which is not something you want to learn as a, you know, 55-year-old person in the entertainment industry, let alone a woman. Because show business is notoriously unforgiving for aging women to succeed. But she persevered and came back with a vengeance. So, as I said, it's an extraordinary and very inspiring story for a time today when people are living longer and everybody's reinventing themselves a few times as they go along. She did it more often and better than anybody.
The early stages of that comeback were quite incredible. She went on Broadway. She also was in Hollywood Squares. It seemed very measured of how she was going to come back, and all the while making it seem like this was very well thought out and planned as to how she was going to...
Well, it wasn't.
Right.
She was actually just desperate for a paycheck, and she would take anyone anywhere, you know, as long as somebody would give her a paid gig. so, you know, she starts, she's offered an opportunity to design and sell some stuff on QVC, and she didn't know how to do that. She didn't know how to run a business, but she becomes a CEO and creates a $1 billion business, you know, selling her jewelry and clothing designs on QVC. She was, you know, as you said, she was a Broadway playwright, an actress, and a Hollywood film director, as well as a screenwriter and a movie actress. She was a radio host. She was a television host. She wrote more than a dozen best-selling books, self-help books, memoirs, fiction. You know, it was, the list was just endless. Reality shows, in addition to her main business, which of course was stand-up comedy, and she just kept pushing forward. And anything that came along, she was never too proud to take a job because she was desperate to work and very motivated to earn money because she thought money was power. Money gives you options, and she was terrified of being poor because there had been a lot of financial strains in her childhood. So really, that was turned out really well for her because her willingness to consider new things and, you know, not to be too proud to take on some of these jobs, they led to more opportunities. So her career kept expanding at a time in life when many people's careers contract.
She came back to television. She did a daily daytime show out of New York City. And then there were several things, as you say, just kept on reinventing herself. Obviously, there was QVC. There was also E! And Fashion Police. And
she invented the red carpet, essentially.
You know?
She just took this dumb little job. She thought it was ridiculous to go and do fashion commentary for awards ceremonies, you know, on E!, and, you know, she wasn't even a fashion expert. So the reason she would go up to people and stick a microphone in their nose and say, "Who are you wearing?" is because she didn't actually know the answer. She wasn't an expert on all the designers. But because she was a comic and would say these snarky, irreverent things, often insulting, and because she brought her daughter Melissa on to be her straight man so she would have somebody to play off of, it became extremely entertaining. And essentially, the formula that they came up with created the whole modern red carpet phenomenon, which has become a multi-billion dollar industry. I mean, these days, you know, there are more hours of red carpet programming leading up to the Academy Awards ceremony than there are covering the ceremony itself. It's a huge deal, but she essentially invented it.
What were the challenges in writing the story and getting the truth? Because she would often elaborate. I mean, shortly before she died, she basically claimed that she got on The Tonight Show in the first place by having sex with Johnny Carson.
Right. She also claimed that Bill Cosby had suggested that they put her on, and neither of those things is probably true. You know, she was always willing to say anything to get publicity and sacrifice whatever the facts might be in favor of a better story. And, you know, there was a lot of image building. She spent her entire life claiming she was Phi Beta Kappa at Barnard, and it finally occurred to me just to double check that. Of course, it wasn't true at all. She didn't earn any honors at all. So one of the challenges was always reminding yourself that you couldn't take anything she said for granted. You always had to double check it. You know, she was 80 years old when she announced to a TMZ camera crew that she'd had a little sexual thing with Johnny Carson, and they were incredulous, and they said, "Are you kidding?" And she said, "Well, of course. How do you think you got on the show?" Now, none of Carson's friends believe that she actually slept with him because he was busy with a lot of very beautiful movie stars at the time. But that particular secret will probably have to have gone to the grave with Carson and Joan Rivers, because only the two of them know for sure.
Shortly before she died, she was doing a press tour for a book, Diary of a Mad Diva. She walked off the set famously of a CNN interview. A few days later, she's on with David Letterman, and I was in the audience for that show. I was two rows from her, and one of the things that shocked me, I was told later by a writer and a producer that none of that was really planned. At least she didn't know about it. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But what I do know is that watching her when Dave walked off, And she just then takes over the show like an old pro.
Which she was
one of the coolest things that I have ever seen. It was an amazing moment.
She would do anything. She loved to rile people up. She loved to, you know, shake it up wherever she was. And she loved the attention. So, you know, when she was, you know, publishing books like that at the very end of her life, you know, she would make up blurbs. I think it was that particular book. She made up a blurb from Marie Antoinette, who's been
yes.
dead for several centuries.
Yes.
And Costco said that it was fraudulent and they didn't want to carry the book, or at least this is what Joan claimed. And so she went to a Costco and chained herself to a shopping cart and had a little demonstration about the fact that Costco wouldn't carry her book. So, of course, all the camera crews showed up, and it was a big to-do, and she got tons of free publicity. So, you know, this was kind of her M.O. She would do everything and anything to make herself into, you know, yet another headline.
Her death was certainly a tragedy, and the way it happened, certainly a tragedy. During that time, she was during those days, she was in her final days, she was the leading news story pretty much everywhere, and people talking about this amazing woman.
I think a lot of people didn't realize how important she was and what an extraordinary career she had had and what an extraordinary impact she had had until she died. She was kind of like wallpaper. She'd always been there, you know. Ever since the 60s, she'd been on, you know, these starting with the Ed Sullivan Show and the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And so she'd always been around, and her death kind of people snapped to attention and focused on the unbelievable amount of stuff that she accomplished over a 60-year career in about 17 different fields. And finally, I think people kind of took notice. She always felt unappreciated, as if while she was alive, she wasn't given her due. And many of her friends felt as though, boy, I wish she'd been alive to see her, you know, obituaries and the accolades and the incredible, you know, eulogies at her funeral, because finally people really articulated what she had meant to the culture and for women and in comedy and in all these other areas where she opened up opportunities. And they felt, boy, she really would have loved all the attention. You know, Howard Stern telling a very funny but very obscene joke at her funeral. And in fact, it was Joan's obscene joke. A lot of people think it was his, but she was always the most fearless of all the comics, you know, and the most cutting edge, because she would say anything, anywhere.
Well, the book is fascinating. It's Last Girl Before Freeway, The Life, Loves, Losses, and Liberation of Joan Rivers. It's published by Little Brown. Leslie Bennett, thank you very much for speaking with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I think she's a really inspiring story, and so I dedicated the book to anybody who has ever lost money or love or jobs or success or youth or beauty or hope, and I think that pretty much includes all of us at one point or another in life. So Joan Rivers is somebody to cheer you up when you're having a hard time, and I hope it's helpful to people.
Again, the name of the book, Last Girl Before Freeway. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.